Welcome to Check It Out, Comrade, an indie game podcast where every 2 weeks we bring you two games by the people for the people and tell you what we like about them. I'm Nick Lauber.
And I'm Gary Butterfield.
And this week we're doing Anatomy and Brigador.
Yeah, you'll notice the second half of this episode we are brought by a guest, or bring you a guest. We are joined by a guest.
There you go.
We are brought by a guest. We have been brought by a guest. We have a guest joining us, Evan Noggle from the Megaton Marathon podcast. We're going to talk about that in the second half. The first half, we're going to get started with Anatomy. Nick, tell me about Anatomy.
Absolutely. So
the game, start talking.
So the knee bone is connected to the
Anatomy
is a it's a 3D adventure game released on itch.io by a developer named Kitty Horror Show. So it's available at kittyhorrorshow.itch.io/anatomy. It's available for $3. Runs on Windows, OS X, and Linux. And it was released. Let's see. I don't know if they have a date on here. I'm not sure when it was released, but it's. Oh, here we go. 1 year ago.
We need Evan to help.
It's been released for about a year. I don't know the exact date because itch doesn't provide that apparently. So it's a like I said, it's a 3D adventure game where you are wandering around a house for about 30 minutes.
Yeah, yeah. It's we're gonna have a spoiler section for this. That'll happen after the Brigador episode. So it's gonna be kind of a weirdly structured episode. But there are some kind of generalities we can talk about. With this, the tagline of this is every house is haunted. It has this kind of, I first heard about this game because of Cole after I played Oxenfree, which was on the thing, and I'm like not a big fan of Oxenfree, but one of the things I thought was kind of interesting was the weird VCR kind of screen tearing aesthetic, and he said like, hey, Anatomy does that really well.
It does do it really well,
and it does. I love it. Like, it is it's kind of presented as like a VHS tape of you exploring, you know, like a Half-Life Engine house.
It's very purposely rudimentary in its 3D. Like, it does not fake like it's trying to be anything super pretty. And it's a dead empty house aside from some tapes and a tape player and a few pieces of furniture.
That's kind of what you know going into it. Other than, I think this is not a spoiler, as you listen to these tapes and you're kind of hearing this lecture. And there's more to it than that, but I don't think this is a spoiler, but this game is not a game about like jump scares. If you look at kind of footage of it or look at screenshots, it maybe seems like, oh, this is going to be like, you know, Slender, The Pages Chronicle, you know, or one of those games where Slender Man chases you around while you pick up pages of things.
Right.
And it's not that.
No.
And it, like, I think, you know, it advertises such as like not being about that sort of thing, which I really appreciate. I think this game is like very spooky and good, but it establishes it entirely through atmosphere and dread. As opposed to, you know, something popping out of a closet.
Yeah. It also does a lot of real good things with not only just like the VHS aesthetic, but also video game 3D-ness. Like, it doesn't hide the fact that this is a video game and these are polygons, and it uses that as a unnerving effect, and it's really, really good.
Yeah. The same way that, like, you know, if old games ever kind of spooked you out because of weird draw distance stuff, you know, there's the fact that like Silent Hill 1 was made, they made that fog to take advantage of the shitty draw distance, because there's something kind of scary about a low fidelity anything.
Right.
You know, it's something that's kind of, inside that uncanny valley, like a representative thing that is not quite there, is always going to be pretty spooky. I think this game does like that kind of sense of dread about as well as, you know, any horror game I've played, in terms purely of like that feeling that something bad's going to happen. I'm reminded of, your friend and mine, Brayton Cameron, who's one of the funniest people I've ever met, has a really funny, you know, bit that he's talked about before, where when he first played Myst, he was real scared, you know, because it's so atmospheric.
Right.
And he wanted to make a game that was like Myst. On the cover, there's like a demon, you know, there's some kind of scary like monster. And then when you play the game, it's just like Myst, like nothing ever pops out. It's just that. Changed. And then do a sequel and it'd be him, the demon on the front, and it'd be say, guess who's back. I think it's one of the funniest like things
that is really funny.
It reminds me of that, where it's just like something's wrong,
right?
You know, and you just kind of have that sense the entire time.
So we're going to come back and talk about this a little bit more, but first we're going to talk about Brigador with Evan. So
the other thing too, if you hear this and it sounds good, and I recommend this, it's $3 and it'll take you about 45 minutes to play.
Yeah.
I think it's a really good time. You have to play it more than once.
Oh, so yeah.
You play, and that's it. The game doesn't tell you that, and I can totally see somebody playing it once and then putting it down and being like, this is dumb.
It does come with a text file that says, like, read this after you play through if you think that's the end. So. Yes.
It just says spoilers, and maybe, you know, but for me, like, I was like, oh, maybe that's collectibles or something, you know. I wouldn't necessarily think that was going to give me instructions.
Right.
Like, it might have been trivia. So.
Yeah, the very first thing it says in there is just, like, you have to play it more than once.
Yeah.
So.
Okay, and for the second game we're talking about, I believe Check It Out Comrade first, even though we might have had Brayton on an episode, we have brought in a guest, Evan Noggle of the Evan. We'll talk about why we brought you in, but let everybody know who you are and how they might know you, other than just the fact that you are a pillar of our community.
Yeah, I'm Evan Noggle. I've done Duck Spring 2 years in a row. I also host a podcast with Brian May and Paul M. Davis called Megaton Marathon, where we, for some reason, have decided it was a good idea to play through every single Megami Tensei game beginning to end.
Yeah, it seems excruciating from the outside. Like, why? Yeah, it does. Like, I'm in favor of those games, but watching, you know, Brian just be like, oh, I gotta finish this.
We just finished playing through Strange Journey, and we were supposed to record every week, and we're on, like, we finally recorded the last episode after almost 8 weeks of podcasting.
Yeah.
Oh, so, wow.
Yeah.
It's a JRPGs aren't fucking around. you gotta get to that that Jack Brothers or whatever the game is that's not a like, isn't there like a Virtual Boy?
Oh yeah, the Virtual Boy game? Jack Brothers. Yeah, I've played that one. It's kind of fun. It's going to be a nice tight 10-minute episode when we cover it.
And nice. And won't take like 3 hours to prepare for.
Yeah, definitely not.
Yeah, so Evan is a part of the community. He is, as we mentioned, Duck Spring is the streaming event that our community puts on. It just recently wrapped up last weekend as we're recording this. And Evan, for that event, played Brigador. Evan also donated during Duck Stream to request this game for the show, and the game is very deep. So me and Nick did not want to do a disservice to it by, you know, kind of giving it a shallow read. And Evan is the kind of, you know, the person on our Slack channel and the person in our community who knows the game the best. So we wanted to bring on an expert.
Awesome.
So Nick, tell us a little, and, you know, Nick, tell us a little bit about Brigador, and then we'll probably ask you some questions. Evan can talk about our own experiences with it and get to the bottom of, why this game is worth playing.
Yeah, and Evan, feel free to correct me or put any additional information in here you might. But Brigador, according to Wikipedia at least, is released on June 2nd, 2016. And it's available on Steam on Windows, OS X, and Linux. And it's a single-player isometric mech game for the most part. It's a mouse aim with keyboard controls. I believe it also has the ability to be played with a controller, but it definitely feels like it's meant to be played with a mouse. And yeah, it's a it has a campaign mode that essentially acts sort of as the tutorial for the main game mode, which allows you to start up missions that are have random enemy placement. I believe the maps are static. Is that correct, Evan?
Yeah, they're all static.
But you get random enemy placement, so you get sort of a roguelike feel to going through those individual missions or series of them. Available in the non-campaign scenario section. Yeah.
And it's hard to, you know, saying it's a kind of isometric mech game kind of tells you a little bit about it, but it's kind of hard to put this in a box.
It's
an action game, but there are really heavy stealth elements. There are really heavy kind of strategy elements, and there are, you know, that kind of keyboard and mouse thing. This is possibly like a shallow comparison, but like the way, reminded me a little bit of Hotline Miami, like how you control it. Like I'm choosing, you know, where my cursor is, where my gun is going to fire at any given point.
Oh, definitely.
Or even like Gungeon or something. But one thing that this has that is distinctly different from those games is that where your mouse lies isn't necessarily like a direct target. Like it's where you're aiming, but your bullets all have an arc. Yeah.
And that's kind of lends to the general sense of complexity because this is a really deep game. Can you, let's I'll let you go first, Evan, and then me and Nick can kind of talk about where we got in this, like how far we made it. But how did you get involved in this? How did you how did it get on your radar, and how long have you kind of been playing it? Because I know you were involved, I believe, in the Kickstarter of it.
So there wasn't a Kickstarter for it, but
or Greenlight.
At least I don't think there
Greenlight
was.
Greenlight was what I was thinking.
Greenlight, yeah. Basically, I got on board because I think it was Austin Walker tweeted a GIF of or GIF. I always forget which one's the right one.
Here's the secret. This mech. It doesn't fucking matter. Yeah. Like, it's whatever one you say is the right one. Like, it's yeah. If and anybody who tries to correct you, you know, go leave, get out, leave the room. Like, you're wasting your time. Like,
you should tell that to the listeners to our podcast that really enjoy the different ways we say Tensai.
Like, I
say Tensai.
If me and Cole ever get to do the Final Fantasy one, I'm gonna make it a thing that he gets to say everyone's name, because I'm so terrible at that, and I don't want like a literal avalanche of corrections of me not knowing how to pronounce a name that's not my native tongue. Like, I'm sorry. It's not like I'm, you know, it's not disrespect. But anyhow, continue.
I guess it was Austin Walker's Twitter. He posted an animated image file of this mech stomping around a highway, just blowing stuff everywhere. And I was like, wow, what is this? And at the time, the game was called Matador. But apparently there's a board game or something like that called Matador. So they eventually had to change their name. And so I was following their Twitter account for nearly a year before they finally went into early access, just looking at their really cool GIFs, really cool pictures. As soon as it came out for sale or early access, I bought it immediately, and I started diving deep in the game. I got maybe 20 hours in the early access version, and I was like, I have to stop. Like, this game isn't finished. This is going to be like Nuclear Throne all over again, where I just play 100 hours of it before it comes out, and then as soon as it gets released, I never touch it.
Right.
So it was sitting there at the top of my library, very forcefully not playing it until it came out this past summer, and I just dove headfirst into it. Did the campaign, started doing the skirmishes, started trying to get better and better at it. And I've basically been playing it not necessarily every day, but once or twice a week. I've been playing it basically constantly since July.
Wow. So it's a real, this hole was made for me situation for you.
Yeah. And I think a lot of that comes from, I used to love like the Desert Strike, Jungle Strike, Urban Strike, all those games. They were isometric helicopter games for the Genesis and for the PC. And I would play those constantly as a kid. They were some of my favorite games. And then all of a sudden this comes along and I'm like, oh, this takes all of like the mouse skills that I learned wasting my time playing Counter-Strike in high school. And it feels a lot like these old Desert Strike games. And it looks awesome. The soundtrack is amazing. And just everything came together into this one, like the perfect Evan game.
It's nice. I love the way it looks so much.
Oh, yeah,
like, it's gorgeous. And it makes me think like this kind of detail and this perspective, because at first, like, kind of glance, it's got that isometric perspective that makes me think of Infinity Engine stuff. And I was just like, man, do I want an Infinity Engine game that like takes place in these environments with destructible environments, you know? Like, yeah. It's just like, man, that's a cool idea, because this is so like intricate. It reminds me of looking at like a model, like one of those like hyper detailed little art models.
Yeah.
And the soundtrack is excellent as well. Like,
Yeah, it's banging. Yeah. It's really good.
It's a straight, it's a cracker, in the British sense. So you've been playing it kind of this whole time, and those two different modes, there's the campaign, which is kind of a tutorial like an RTS might do. And then there is the skirmish mode, which adds those random elements. So gives it that kind of replayability. Even though the levels aren't different. The enemy placement makes a huge difference. It's the levels are just kind of this wireframe on which they're placed. They're one of the things, so I'll just kind of speak to my experience with the game, checking it out. I know this is a common kind of complaint about the game. I think it takes a long time to get used to controlling it. And I feel like by the time I had to tap out because we had to record the episode, I feel like I'm like 75% there.
Yeah, I agree. Yeah, it's probably about where
it's
at.
Like, I'm not good at it. I can do things, and because the levels are easy, it kind of makes it feel like what the game would be like if me, Gary Butterfield, like got into a mech and just, you know, because I can't drive a car, so me like trying to like drive this thing, you still get the job done, but I'm constantly like backing over buildings on accident and like,
yeah,
you know, killing civilians I didn't need to kill, things like that. And I know that there's this kind of like high level of mastery. So like what happens is I will kind of play it and get to, you know, be doing fine, and then just have either like a stroke of bad luck or fuck up. and just have no tools to get out of it. You know, I'm not good enough to like make my hands, you know, do the thing I want them to do, make my mech do the thing I want to do. Which is just kind of like, man, I know that it wasn't like something where I felt like it was unfair. I could practice and get it, but I think that curve really makes itself kind of known.
Yeah, it's just the lack of like you had those strike games to prepare you for this. You know, I don't think I've ever played a game that quite controls with these sort of tank controls on your left hand and aim on the right hand. Not even like I didn't really even play any of the MechWarrior games, so not having anything to fall back on in terms of experience with this control scheme means that the entire first part of this game is me just trying to get grasp with it.
And it's the one of the things that made it hard for me. And again, this is not necessarily a flaw. It's just something you have to get good at. We don't usually have show notes for this, but I'll put a link to the Duck Spring things. You can kind of see what high level play looks like. This was one of those games where I was like, I wonder what it looks like if somebody's really good at this. So even before I talked to you, Evan, I like looked it up. And then also another member of the community, WeGraph, did a basics kind of video of this. That's really good.
Yeah.
Is that I feel like there's a lot of things to keep your attention on the screen. Everything is small. So there's the kind of that part of it, but then there's also just like, okay, which way am I facing? What are my two different, firing arcs at any given time? Not only what are their Z axis, but how far away are they? What are my ammo counts, my armor health? What are, you know, my mission objectives and then creature, you know, the creatures, you know, the mechs and people you're fighting, even down to that. So like what icon does this, enemy have over its head? Does that, you have to like quickly prioritize that. It's like very rapid triage for a game that has a deep strategic element. And so is that, are any of the things that I'm saying that like were hurdles for me? Are those common or am I a dipshit? Okay.
Oh, definitely. I had the exact same experience you guys did. Like, I think it took me a really long time before I found like a loadout in a vehicle where so the mechs made no sense to me when I first started because just the way they work, like you hit W on your keyboard, WASD is the normal controls. W moves you forward, A and D rotate your legs, but your mouse rotates your chassis. So yeah. Like I would constantly get into a situation when I first started where I had no idea which way I was facing and I would think I'm going to walk in one direction and all of a sudden, nope, I'm walking right toward the thing I want to run away from. And then on top of all of that, you also got to consider things like you take more damage from the back. So where your legs face actually has a direct impact on how much damage you're going to take from the shots coming at you. And there's so many little things like that I found so overwhelming to start with that after a few hours, I tried out a couple different vehicles. The anti-gravity, like kind of the hover cars, they can strafe instead of turn. You choose where they face by pointing your mouse in the direction you want them to face.
Those feel a lot more natural coming from other mouse aim games.
I wasn't good with them at first, but those I was able to kind of like, that's how I got my handle on it. And once I spent, and it was like a good 6-7 hours before I felt like I really was comfortable playing this game. That's when I finally felt like, okay, I'm competent enough to try a mech again. And I'm still not great with them, but and this is talking to somebody with 100 hours in this game. Like, I'm still not great with one third of the vehicles in this game.
Does the facing thing with the back, is that the back of your legs exclusively, the back of your chassis or both?
I think it's the back of your legs. Yeah, because the legs have armor on the front of them, but they have no armor on the back. And it's the same thing with all the vehicles, whatever the back of your lower half or for the A-Gravs, the back of your entire thing.
The tank controls themselves aren't the thing for me. Like, as somebody who's played a lot of Resident Evil and survival horror games, like, I can do tank controls. It is the fact that you're not controlling your facing. Like, the facing of your chassis or your gun or whatever being independent from your legs. That's literally, if you had to pinpoint the part of this that makes it hard for me to control.
If you were just moving with the WAS and D, even though you're rotating left and right with A and D, that'd be fine.
Yeah.
But the fact that you're aiming on top of that and it's spinning you, like, it makes you feel like you actually are rotating your legs as well, but you're not.
And that just, that was just a disconnect for me. That was super tricky. It's also something where, like, you know, you're talking about a build. For this, like, there's kind of a mech and you know, I know that the pilots have kind of different attributes, and then the weapons have different attributes, and your you get a utility item as well, and these are all like really different and kind of lend themselves to different play styles and builds, which I think is really cool. Something I didn't get far enough in the game to know if this is true. Does the game do a good job of kind of honoring that freedom of choice? So, like, are there missions where If you are not playing this as a tank, it's going to be a 100% uphill battle. Or if you are not playing this as kind of a stealth hit and run character, you are going to have a 100% uphill battle. Are the missions designed to be approached from different kind of play styles?
Oh, definitely.
Okay.
There are a couple of missions that, depending on what playstyle you have, it's going to be incredibly difficult. But those are mostly skirmish missions, and the skirmish missions are designed to be played in chunks. Basically, the more missions you complete in a row, the bigger your payout at the end is. And your payout can be used to buy more vehicles for the skirmish mode, more weapons, more pilots, more missions. The biggest mission, the one I tried to do during Duck Spring, and failed miserably when I backed up into an explosive pipe because I was too distracted by everything else. With those missions, you're taking on anywhere between one and up to, I think the biggest one is 31 levels in a row. Without
Wow. dying.
The one I was trying was 18 levels in a row, and that's all the skirmish maps one after another.
Mm.
With those things, there are certain levels where if you're a small stealthy vehicle, it's going to be really difficult because there's real big open areas, there are big arenas, and as soon as one enemy notices you and fires their big loud gun at you, because noise is a factor in the stealth as well as sight. If they fire something loud, everybody will notice and come to investigate. Then all of a sudden you have to deal with this big empty room full of enemies. But it's not the kind of thing where it's impossible because of that. And there are other levels where if you're playing a real slow vehicle, you can get trapped in a choke point. Whereas if you're playing a light, stealthy vehicle, you can get out of it.
Mm-hmm.
So mostly it's not a matter of one build being stronger than another and certain maps like really punishing it so much as you have to understand the limitations of your build and approach each map differently, depending on those limitations.
One of the things you said something that it reminded me of something that I appreciated when I watched the live stream, is that you're talking about how the stealth is explained in the fiction,
mm-hmm.
Which I like, because one of the things that I had a heart, somebody had to tell me, I had to read and have you or WeGraph in the Slack channel tell me that this was a stealth game that benefits from that. Because one of the strengths of the game, or one of the immediate appeals, is that it has this sense of bombast. Like you're just, walking through buildings that collapse and everything's destructible. And it seems like if you were on the ground there, everything would be super loud and there would be no way for something not to know you're there. I just walk through a building. Like, of course, everyone in this town knows I'm there. I walk through a building, mm-hmm. And then you had said that in the audiobook, they talk about what the stealth actually is in the game.
Yeah. And so there's actually two things that factor into why you're able to be stealthy in this game. The first thing is, yes, stealth is basically you shutting down all of your systems that emit electromagnetic radiation, just running quiet and slipping through the enemies, because they're not just relying on line of sight to detect you. They're relying on radar, LIDAR, different means of detecting electronic devices in the area. And you shut all that down and you kind of sneak by, and that's represented in game by if you get close enough to the enemy where they could reasonably see you, if it's just a dude looking out of a window, then they will see you and start shooting you even when you're stealthed.
Mm.
And the second half to it is one of the major stealth components of this game is there's a concept of alert phases, where if you alert special sentry units, it'll alert all the units on the map and they'll all come together and group up and try to find you. The way that's explained is that most units can't actually communicate with Mother Base because there's a citywide communications blackout.
Mm.
And I don't know how much we want to go into like spoilers or the story or anything like that, but basically a hostile actor has shut down the entire computer network for the city. And so the only people that can communicate with HQ and like radio in alerts to other units are these units that have long range comms gear built into them.
Mm.
I see. Yeah, I really like a lot how you explained a little bit of the lore stuff on the stream and various points, like what they make available to you just going through the campaign. Like, I really do dig the like setting of this game a lot. Mm-hmm.
I mean, it's not a spoiler to talk about the premise.
Yeah, in fact, I think that's probably a pretty good question. Do you feel are any spoilers to this game, or is there just sort of a depth of lore to come to understand?
Yeah, I mean, I guess there's no spoilers in so much as, like, how could you spoil the item description for an item in Dark Souls? Because it kind of tells most of the story, aside from the audiobook, it tells most of that story the same way, where when you buy a gun, you can then look at the intel for that gun, and every single item, character, vehicle in the game has a little write-up written by a military intelligence officer of the opposition to whatever group developed that item or whatever.
That's really neat.
And as you unlock them, you gain more bits of the story. And like one of my favorite things about it is, so I'll get into the first, the premise is basically you have this planet that has cut off all outside access. You live in a galaxy or so, a galaxy or part of a galaxy that's under essentially like hypo anarcho capitalist, corporate rule. Corporations own the planets and everybody owned them. And this one planet decided to wall them all themselves off from the corporation, and they installed these massive orbital guns to fend off the corporation's invasion ships to prevent them from reclaiming their assets after a people's revolt. The problem is those guns bankrupted the planet, and because it's a planet, they didn't have any way to get more resources in from outside, so they've been living under poverty for decades. And so there's this massive people's uprising to try to overthrow this military dictatorship running the planet and protecting them from the corporations. And so they sneak in, and the game takes place after this happens, by the way, after what I'm about to tell you. They sneak into the, or somehow they get into the central complex where the leader of all these militaries is housed. They kill him, and then, as these people are about to seize power, the corporation comes in, they take over every single computer, every single speaker, everything planet-wide, and they broadcast an open contract. Kill military officers, destroy military infrastructure, including the orbital guns, and eliminate military vehicles. Eliminate the military. And you'll be rewarded handsomely and given transit off-planet. And everybody on the planet gets this communique. So, like, if you're a pilot sitting in there with all of your friends, all of a sudden, like, you were told, like, become rich by killing your commander and wiping out your squad, then getting to a spaceport and getting out. Mm-hmm. So, in the middle of the civil war that's just launched minutes ago, everybody is suddenly turning on each other and trying to get out. It's,
yeah, like,
I love it.
Yeah, it's this kind of, you know, super anarchy, kind of, because it originally seemed like, when I first started seeing kind of like hints of it and the stuff they do tell you in the mode, is like, oh, this is some kind of like citizens revolt kind of thing. Like, it is initially easy to cast the players, at, you know, as something that is, you know, good, and then maybe they would mess with that and there'd be a twist or something like that. But it's not that, you know. it is literally just it's Smash TV. Like, it's like every man for themselves to start fucking shit up.
Yeah, you're either playing as a member of the military that defected and started killing his comrades, or you're a member of the People's Revolution that defected and started killing his comrades, or you're the member of these hyper-capitalist mercenaries that have come down to the planet to kill people for money.
Yeah, to kill other people's comrades.
Yeah.
Yeah. So that's the this is definitely the game about comrade killing.
Comrades.
Yeah. Killing comrades.
I really like the people's faction as well, and how their vehicles kind of reflect that they're scrapped together from various miscellaneous parts and stuff. Like the car you showed on stream that's just got like panels all sewn onto it.
Oh yeah, the Pompadour. It's a flying sedan.
It's rad.
That's a super cool idea. It's really neat. And I know you talked about this, because I know you said you had watched interviews and stuff. You talked about this a little bit on Slack. This game is getting, you know, so it didn't get tons of attention or a lot of sales, but it's getting relaunched. Yes.
Yeah. So there was a couple of things. It was an indie games conference. I can't remember the name of one, but one of the two developers, it was two brothers that were the primary developers of this game. One of them was given a talk about how like the game failed mostly because of its control scheme. He feels like there was a lot of people in the press, like Austin Walker, Jeff Gerstmann, who picked up the game, played it. There was even an unfinished on Giant Bomb, but none of them ended up sticking with it. Jeff Gerstmann mentioned the music during the Game of the Year stuff, but like, people in the press would pick up this game and they'd see this, like, oh, I have no idea how to play this. This makes no sense to me. Then they would just move on and forget about it and just got lost in the wash. And as a result, it sold, the talk was in November, and he was talking about this game selling only 10,000 copies and how people were returning the game saying that, I have no idea how to control this. This should be a twin stick shooter. This looks like a twin stick shooter. Why is this so hard to control? And so, yeah, they're planning on relaunching it this summer with a, this is all from the talk. So like, I don't think they've announced anything absolutely concrete, but the plan is, relaunch it this summer with a new campaign designed to ease people into how to play it a little bit better, and new control options. Because the game also had a twin-stick mode right up until it launched, and then right before launch, they took it out and decided, we're going to have you learn the quote-unquote best way possible to play this game. And again, like, everybody knows how that turned out.
Right.
Yeah. Yeah, it's one of those things where I appreciate it. I understand the idea behind, like, you know, the real depth of this game is if you mess with it, you know, or if you mess with it, if you get like deep into it, you know, if you, and However, like, learning curves are a thing, and letting people kind of enjoy it on their own, you know, come at it from their own direction, I think is probably positive. So, like, you know, they're not going to get rid of anything. There's still going to be the ultra hardcore kind of mode that they have now, you know, but there will be a version where people can say, like, hey, this kind of plays a little bit like, you know, like it looks like,
yeah,
you know, and I'm in favor of that. I think that's a good idea. And we'll be, you know, look forward to revisiting it then probably.
Yeah.
You know, it's, I was always in the perpetual like edge of this where I'm like, I like this a lot. It's just, it reminds me of something people have said about Dark Souls too, where it's like, I've got this much time. Do I feel like losing? You know? And it's like, that kept happening. It's like, you know, this is fun, but I can't, it's going to be satisfying when I get past this mission, but I'm keep losing the mission.
Right.
You know?
Yeah. One of the worst things you can say about a game is that my friends list is full of people that have played it for 45 minutes and never again.
Yeah.
Yeah. Well, hopefully people will give it a shot, and hopefully the relaunch goes really well.
Absolutely.
Because this is definitely cool. It is, it's made by a bunch of like Something Awful people too, which is kind of fun. There are a bunch of Easter eggs and things like that in there.
Yeah, it's a reference to Rope Kid, right? One of the vehicles.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. One of the really cool, fast, stealthy vehicles is called Rope Kid.
Yeah.
And there's like, signs that say YCS, scattered around
nice.
Red light district.
Yeah.
Oh yeah. There's a big Brigador thread on Bad Game, which is alarming to me. Like, I was like, this is the only community that actually is really lifting this game up is the offshoot of SA of all the people who were in the joke games forum that got kicked out.
Yeah. Cool. Well, yeah. Is there anything else? Any kind of final bits or anything that we want to hit on before we wrap it up?
I think we touched on all the big important parts. It's beautiful. It sounds good, and it's hard to play.
those are all true.
Any final pulling bit of lore, or interesting tidbit you'd want people to know going into it?
This is probably the game that has the least amount of ludonarrative dissonance of any game I've ever played. You're blowing up buildings, you're destroying infrastructure, you're intentionally or not killing lots and lots of people, which fits perfectly with how the game sets up your character as this like money or nothing sociopathic jerk. So they've told a very good cyberpunk story, and that's kind of the best thing I can say about it.
I agree with you.
It's extremely an amoral game.
Yeah.
And that's, you know, that's a, there's a kill screen review of it that really emphasizes that. And it's, you know, it, but you're right in that when you say like lack of ludonarrative dissonance, like it's non-pretentious in that.
Yeah.
Like it's just, there's almost like a grindhouse sensibility to the, like, you know, it's like the Purge. Like, hey, everybody, you are all, I have this bounty open to you.
It's
get purging.
It's Hotline Miami minus all the reflection.
Yeah, or Hotline Miami if the guys called everyone.
Yeah.
You know? They left an auto dialer on all afternoon, and just like everyone got the same automated message about who to kill. Evan, I know we talked about it a little while ago, but remind everybody where they can find you online.
Right now you can find me along with Brian May and Paul M. Davis at MegatonMarathon.com, where we do a supposedly bi-weekly podcast about all the Megami Tensei games.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and you guys can fucking pronounce Tensei any way you want. I'm giving you permission if you need it. I will write a note to the governing authority of podcasts that you guys can say that however you like.
I appreciate that.
Yeah, no problem. If you like this show that me and Nick do, you can support the entire network on Patreon. If you go to patreon.com/duckfeedtv, even, you know, a couple of bucks, really do appreciate that. Even a little bit. This is also the first episode that's come out that we recorded since I've been running my Kickstarter. Mm-hmm. So when this episode comes out, there is time to back the Atomic book, the sequel, the second Power Worlds book I'm doing based on Fallout. So if you go to my Twitter, you can find a link there. It's a big nightmare Kickstarter link. It's all letters and numbers that don't mean anything. So go to my Twitter instead. That's twitter.com/GARYBUH. And we are almost there. We're about $500 short. So, yep. And we got plenty of time. So we're going to hopefully hit some of those cool stretch goals.
If you have any recommendations or comments about the show, you can hit us up on facebook.com/checkitoutcomrade or @comradepodcast on Twitter. And there's always contact forms available on DuckFeedTV and checkitoutcomrade.com.
Yeah, and ratings, reviews are all very helpful as well.
Absolutely. So yeah, I think that's about it. Thanks again for joining us, Evan. It was very kind to have you.
Thank you.
Okay, so it's going to be a quick little spoiler ditty here before we go back to talking about anatomy. Okay, so back to anatomy for a bit here. So yeah, the we talked about how you're listening to like a lecture, and it's someone. Every tape that you get on that first playthrough is all pieces of someone giving a lecture, comparing a house to a body, and making correlations between kind of each portion, each room of a house, and its correlated piece of the body and what it represents. For the first playthrough, that's pretty straightforward. Like you learn that story, but then start to pick up on there's another voice that starts coming through.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And shortly after that voice comes through and talks about something about the basement, the game just closes out on you.
Yeah, and there is like, you know, there aren't jump scares so much, but the game just goes.
Yeah, you know. It just kind of ends on you. And I actually did jump at one point, and I specifically remember because Carrie made mention of it. She was like, "But it just scared you? Like the game just closed and I jumped. Like that's all it took.
Just like it crashed and kind of destroyed you." Yeah, it is. So you play through that first time, you get the story. It's just kind of like an essay. It sounds like a college lecture.
Mm-hmm.
Of somebody talking about what a house is, you know, and these kind of correspondences that, you know, are all pretty plausible, you know, as things.
Mm-hmm.
When you open it up, the other thing it kind of plays with, and you talked about this a little bit, is that idea of it being a video game is this like corrupted file,
yeah,
kind of thing. It's like the game world itself on each successive playthrough becomes more and more degraded,
yeah,
in a way that takes advantage of the medium, like takes advantage of not only the VHS part, but that it's a game.
Yeah, it plays fully into sort of the creepypasta trope of like a haunted game, right? Where the game itself is changing.
Yeah. Down to, and you know, nothing ever can happen to you. You can't, there's no fail states.
Right.
But you open a door and there are like black hairs growing out of the ceiling, you know, these things that look like hairs to me. Which really does make this whole thing seem like this house seem like a teratoma, you mm-hmm. know, like this living thing that is growing and literally growing hair, you know. So there's one point in one of the guest rooms, there's like this kind of like blob thing that's the only I think circular object in the game. kind of growing, and it's so weird looking after spending this time kind of iterating on this like blocky Half-Life engine, you know, house.
And it starts throwing elements of the house itself just kind of into disarray. Those like door frames all kind of ajar. You open one door and there's another one behind it.
Yeah.
There's windows that are like clipping into each other.
Yeah.
I think one of the very first things you see on the second playthrough is like pictures kind of Z-fighting where they're blinking in and out.
Mm-hmm.
And it looks like someone just misplaced the texture. Like it looks like it was done incorrectly, but it does give you like this real unnerving sense of like, why is this game being so weird all of a sudden?
Yeah. And the you start getting, you know, sometimes the tapes are just like distorted noises.
Yeah.
You still have to go find them to kind of continue the game. But sometimes they're nothing. Until you know, ultimately the first kind of like big stinger thing is, you know, the master bedroom, which they are initially compared to a brain, they compare to a mouth.
Yeah.
And you go in there and there are teeth growing from the ceiling and floor, and you know the game closes. You just kind of do this and the corruption gets worse and worse, and you get this kind of story about somebody who is in the house, you know, or the house itself, the story from the perspective that somebody was kind of trapped or killed in the basement,
right?
And again, this could turn into a like a real kind of shitty Slender the Awakening thing where it's like, you know, you have to free their spirit, but nothing like that ever happens. You just eventually you get trapped in the basement as well. There's no story for that person. And you get to this last level that kind of opens up, that gets you there. And these, I didn't find this out until like well after I played, or I would have played it more. These are randomized. There are a few different ones of that kind of last level.
Oh, like the last level where you wander around the street and stuff.
You're not always wandering around the street.
Oh,
yeah. The street one I didn't get. I saw that on a video. The one I got was, like a really weird abstract video game environment.
Oh wow.
It was still outdoors, but it was like, you know, and eventually you come across a house, but it's in this like alien landscape for me.
Oh yeah, so mine was like, it was very clearly kind of a suburban street like neighborhoody thing, but all the houses except for the one that you were in previously are just the frames and the foundations.
Mm.
There's no actual houses left. It's just like skeletons of houses and then the one house that you can go into.
Yeah. There's also ones where it's just tons of identical houses, which I love that implication that like, hey, this is this kind of spooky thing you've been engaging with. Here's dozens of them in a row.
P.S. This is every house. Be afraid of all houses now.
Yeah. Cause like, I mean, you know, being in a house alone is spooky.
Yep.
You know? So it's pretty cool. Kitty Horror Show is really neat. I've looked at a couple of their other games and want to play other ones. Like they're all either free or a couple bucks. They're all the same kind of thing. Like these short experiences, and they do weird things with the medium. Like there's one where like your frame rate is locked at 15 frames per second.
Mm-hmm.
So just to make everything look kind of like surreal and video gamey.
That's cool.
You know, they do things like that. So I think that's pretty rad.
It is rad. Yeah, I think that's probably about it. The only other thing I want to mention about is like the second voice I was talking about as it comes through, it starts clearly being the perspective of the house. It's the house talking to you through these tapes at this point when you hear the woman's voice, and it kind of goes on this whole tirade about what it means for a house to be abandoned, what happens when the house is no longer lived in, right? And I think that although it's sort of a disconnect between like what you're actually doing and the story it's telling, I really do like the personification of a house and like trying to think about what the house would feel if the house could feel after it's just been abandoned and left for ruin.
Mm-hmm.
That's a really cool setting, but one that I would never think of to create a video game in.
It reminds me a little bit. I like there's a the Remains of the Day or whatever, which is I've not seen that movie, but I just kind of know the premise, and I think it's about The Things We Carried. There's something like those things where it's about like kind of staunch, stuffy British butlers, but about how we're kind of defined by the things we have around us and the things we kind of surround ourselves with.
Mm-hmm.
You know, there's something like that. It kind of reminded me a little bit of that. You know, like what those things are that we surround ourselves with or define ourselves by when we don't exist.
Right.
You know, and how they kind of lose that meaning.
Yep.
And stuff. So
it's neat.
It's super cool. I like it a lot.
All right. So that's about it. We already did all the admin stuff. So thanks for listening, guys, and we'll see you next time.
Yep. Take care.